Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. In 1945, as World War II ended, the Allied forces moved across Europe and they liberated the Nazi concentration camps. The prisoners in the camps were starving, sick, and surrounded by corpses. Still, victory was won, and they were then free. But according to a Brookline rabbi who was an infant survivor of the Holocaust, 1945 was a year of extraordinary unimportance because, he says, it marked the end of the war, but hardly the end of the Holocaust. Those who survived the unimaginable conditions of the camps had endured one traumatic journey, but they were beginning another. They had to learn to function in a world where family and friends had been killed, their community and identity nearly erased. Rabbi Joseph Pollack is Rabbi Emeritus of the Hillel House at Boston University. He's also Assistant Professor of Public Health at the BU School of Public Health. His new book is called After the Holocaust, The Bells Still Ring. Pollack and his family were seized by Nazis before his first birthday and taken to Westerbork. That was a concentration camp in the northeastern Netherlands. They were sent to another concentration camp, Bergen-Belsen, in northern Germany, 4 months later and were liberated before Pollack's third birthday. Rabbi Pollack is going to be speaking about his book with Elie Wiesel tomorrow afternoon at Facing History and Ourselves. He joins us now in the studio. Nice to have you here, Rabbi.
Nice to be here.
You were a toddler when you were in the concentration camps, but you write in this book about things that you remember even then, such as poplar trees and the sound of the German and Dutch languages. Can you describe for us those early memories?
The early memories are impressionistic. The poplar trees stir something in my body.
You mean now, even?
Even now, yeah, that I know comes from there. Do I have visual memory of it? No. But the first time I saw poplar trees, certainly in Europe, I knew that this was associated with the Holocaust. It took me years to figure out what it was.
Because did you see them around the camps?
Yes, they were part of the topography of Westerbork, and Westerbork is at the youngest point of my childhood in the Holocaust.
One of the other things you write in the book that you remember is the sound of your father's breathing.
This is a scene. We're on a train, became known as the lost transport, into northeastern Germany. Right next to the Polish border, where we're eventually liberated. There were 2,500 Jews on this train, mostly Dutch, and the train is eventually liberated by the Russians. Virtually everybody on this train is suffering from typhus. Typhus is a dreadful disease that is characterized mostly by high fever and loose bowels. And I'm with my mother and my father, and I had some sense, some memory of them being completely out of their minds because of the fever. And I have a memory of my father coughing. I have a memory of the sound of his voice, and I certainly have a memory of the sound of my mother's voice because its pitch had changed. She was a soprano, and it was down like a bass when she was speaking.
These memories, I mean, you describe them in, I guess, as much of a vivid way as you possibly can, but you were, of course, extremely young. And one of the things you write about in the book is that older survivors, as you were growing up, dismissed your memories and your experience, saying that you're not one of them because you were so young at the time. In the book, you call this the Jewish version of Holocaust denial. What do you think they were actually denying?
Well, remember that 1945 or even 1955 is not 2015. Kids were generally dismissed. Kids were not taken seriously. Now we live in a culture where every child is listened to carefully, no child is left behind, and so on. In those days, it was not fashionable. It wasn't part of the culture to take kids seriously. So whatever anybody said, certainly somebody like me, said about the Holocaust, come on, you know, you don't remember, you don't know. And this you don't know, turns out to have had a very bad effect on child survivors. It was just repetitive invalidation of their experiences.
Well, what was the experience that you thought, I mean, you were very young. What experience did you think should be added to the conversation? What was your contribution?
What I think they should have said was, yes, you feel something. Yes, your body remembers something. That would have been very helpful. But this constant harping on the... And this did not come just from one person in my life. It was universal. Whenever you met an adult survivor and you started talking about the Holocaust, they said, oh, you don't remember anything. Thank God you were a child. Mm-hmm. Thank God you were a child. And I have these conversations with Elie Wiesel. Thank God I was a child. Elie Wiesel was 14 when he was taken to the camps. I said, you had 14 fabulous years with your family. You had a wonderful family. You were at your grandparents' house. You were at your parents' house. It was a happy, warm family. I had 3 months with my family. And then I was taken to Vesterbork and to Bergen-Belsen. I had nothing. And my group of survivors really, really suffered, sometimes to the point of madness in adult life. Because of this.
You, when you and your mother arrived in Montreal in 1948, your grandmother said to your mother, I don't want to ever hear about what you went through in Europe. You're starting a new life here. Was that a common sentiment?
Yes. The only people that survivors could talk to about their experience, with exceptions, of course, they're sensitive people in every generation, but the only people that survivors could talk to was each other. And I remember that on Saturday afternoons, we went to a friend's house, and there was some talk of the Holocaust, but they were survivors. These were people that were with us in Bergen-Belsen.
And when did it become more a part of the public parlance?
It's a very interesting question. There's an academic answer to that. Raoul Hilberg told me the answer to it. He said his book was published on the Holocaust in 1961. Think about it. Night was also published in 1961.
Elie Wiesel's book.
And no one, they were not popular. They were not really read very widely. Something happened around 68, 69, 70 that changed all that. And what he told me was that when it became fashionable to criticize governments, people started talking about the Holocaust. And those were the Vietnam years.
Because of government's silence on the Holocaust as it was unfolding?
Because nobody criticized governments for doing anything. It wasn't fashionable. You had respect for the government. You had respect for the ruling authority. And it was only with the almost universal response to the Vietnam War that there's something wrong here, that it became permissible, if you like.
And it became permissible for you to speak about it more openly, or at least to face your past, when you turned 50 years old. Why was that?
That's a funny answer to that. When I turned 50 years old, something happened inside of me, that all of a sudden I became strong. All of a sudden I became passionate. I really had to find out what happened.
Why, do you think?
I'm going to tell you. And I came back. I went to Paris to give a paper at a Jewish Law Society conference. And I said to my wife, you know, as long as I'm in Paris, I'm going to go visit Bergen-Belsen. She almost fell off her chair. I'd never done that before. So I went and I came back, gave a big lecture here at BU. 200 people showed up. It was very nice. And then I said, why am I doing this? What caused this change in my behavior that I can't learn enough about it? And I found an academic paper published by the School of Social Work at Bar-Ilan University that said, child survivors of the Holocaust start looking at their past when they turn 50. I was on schedule.
You were quite average in your special way.
That's right.
What did you look for at Bergen-Belsen? What did you find?
I went into Bergen-Belsen, and I really was scared, and I didn't know what to say. So this is in the book, and I said to the historian at the desk, I spent a couple of months here in summer camp, I said.
Summer camp.
Yeah. I said, do you have any record of me here? And he punched my name and my birth date into the computer and started to spit out the details about me there. And then I was a transformed human being. I was finally validated in a way, as a survivor, in a way that even my mother couldn't do for me.
One of the really powerful moments in the book is when the ministers of culture for Lower Saxony, the minister for culture in Germany, is bringing you and the other survivors through Bergen, Germany. And he says that the parents of most Germans left them with, quote, an inheritance of moral squalor, and that many Germans deal with that by putting up money for institutions that will document the reality of the Holocaust. I wonder if you can read, you have your book in front of you, I wonder if you can read what you then imagine yourself saying in response.
Yeah, it's really important to understand. I never said it. But here it is, what came to mind. I said, there is nothing you can do that will ever redeem either your parents or yourselves from the moral squalor you describe. No amount of money, no amount of virtue can ever bring light to the darkness that your country has created. The deeds of your parents cannot be forgotten. And as long as memory stirs, as long as the word Auschwitz continues to bring a shudder to the human frame, you are doomed to be their representatives, and your hands will be stained with blood that you yourselves may not have spilled. For as long as people remember history, or hear a Jewish story, or see a Jewish child, you are destined both to take responsibility for this darkness and never, ever to be forgiven for it.
So the hand stained with blood forever, no forgiveness, no redemption, is that?
I think that it is not up to the survivors to forgive the Germans. I don't think it's up to the Jewish people to forgive the perpetrators. I think it's something they have to take on themselves. And something they have to deal with themselves. We cannot speak for the dead. We cannot speak for the murdered. Who can?
So how do you put the issue of forgiveness or at least acceptance in your own mind then?
We had a student here at Boston University years ago who came to spend a year working for Cesar Chavez and the farm workers. As penance for Auschwitz. Now, he was born after the war, it goes without saying, and he said, would you give me an office at Hillel? Of course I said yes. Of course I said yes. He felt he had to cleanse his soul, and I think we have to help that process. But it's not up to us to forgive.
Why did you say yes?
Did
it do something for you?
It's not about doing things for me. This is a student. He came to me with a clear, transparent soul, and he said, I need this. Can you help it happen? And I'm going to say yes.
One other thing I found very interesting, and it's hard to read some aspects of this book. I mean, when you decided that you were going to invest yourself into the past and what happened to your family, you went right into the most harsh perspectives, even imagining what it was like as typhus was overtaking the concentration camp and what it must have been like for your mother. But there's one thing I wonder if you can mention. It's a big idea. We don't have a lot of time for it. But the idea that you want Jews now to resuscitate God's reputation after the Holocaust.
I actually think that Jews have succeeded in doing that. My argument is it's interesting. There have been a number of studies that have discovered, to everyone's surprise, that Jews who were fully observant before the Holocaust were fully observant after the Holocaust, that it didn't create the atheism you might think would happen. And from that, I got the idea that the Jews were not going to be be dictated to by Hitler as to what their religious beliefs are going to be. They wouldn't allow that either. And so I think that, atheism is not the alternative. Remembering is the alternative.
Thank you very much for speaking with us. Rabbi Joseph Pollack, his book is called After the Holocaust, The Bells Still Ring. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Lisa Mullins. Thanks for joining us.